The good.
The good.
The bad.
The bad.
And
the ugly.
The ugly. Ugly. With Terence Pillay.
Stella Lacranzi, thank you so much for talking to us. What a treat to have you. Tell me about this new series of documentaries that is being launched.
Thanks for taking the opportunity to speak to me, Terence. The honor is all mine. We set off on a journey about 3 years ago. I, together with Karin Loubser from Brainwave Productions, we had this idea of telling some stories that Madiba told me over the years, and specifically in Afrikaans. Can you believe it that 30 years after his release, there's nothing that's been done exclusively in Afrikaans about Madiba's history. So I felt an almost self-imposed obligation to tell some of these stories, also to allow the Afrikaans-speaking community to be part of it, but not excluding anyone, so it's all subtitled. So we follow Madiba's footsteps more or less, but it is not the Madiba, the ordinary Madiba history or Madiba story. We've looked at specifically the people and the places, the environment that shaped the character of Nelson Mandela. We all are brought up in our own communities, and it impacts our lives and it prepares us for the rest of our lives. So I wanted to know, what is it that made Nelson Mandela the character that I met in 1994 when I walked into the Union Buildings? And we've come across some extraordinary discoveries. It was like a treasure a chest for me opening as well, you know, things that I never expected to find. And then also the magical part of it, of standing in the bedroom where Madiba slept when he went to boarding school, sitting at the tree that he used to sit as a little boy at the Regent's house. You know, there's these little things, standing in the Palace of Justice, walking up from the holding cells into the Palace of Justice and trying to imagine what went through his mind before he was given life sentence. So those are all the things that I relived and that I wanted to know more about. And I wanted to feel, and I wanted to also recall some of these stories that he told me. And that is the 6-part series. It's 52-minute episodes over, as I say, 6 parts.
So Zelda, never mind you that know Mandela so well and so intimately. You know, anyone who's ever known or met the man knows that there's just so much about him out there. How did you go about the task of choosing what makes it into the series?
Well, first of all, we didn't want to tell my story. It's not about me. And I didn't want to tell Madiba's story, you know, his all his life events. I wanted specifically to look at the places and the people and the role of his tradition, for instance, in his life. So at first, when Karin and I set off on this journey, it was murky. We didn't really know where this was going. And then we did an interview with the now deceased Eddie Daniels in Cape Town. And he recollected some memories of Madiba, and I was very anxious because he was diagnosed with 2 types of cancer. And the interview with Eddie that day pretty much set the tone for the rest of the series. It is really about how people also perceived him, what he meant to them, what he meant to the world, but then how they also influenced him and what they think, the people who knew him, what they think shaped his character, what events in his life, you know, shaped his character or the person. So it was a difficult and daunting task, and this is definitely not the alpha and the omega on Nelson Mandela's history. This is just a single part of hopefully colouring in this broader picture of Nelson Mandela's very complicated life life path, as I would say. So it is not perfect. I don't think anything that's ever done or that's been done about Madiba can ever be perfect and satisfy everyone. But for us, it is the story we wanted to tell. You know, to look around the events of his mother's death. What role she played in his life. What type of person was Nosekeni Mandela really? So those are the things that really interested me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think that set the tone.
So, I mean, you are telling these stories along the way. Do you bring any of your kind of personal interaction and information that you might have had with Madiba over the years, does that make it into the series?
Yes, some of it. You know, of course, there's a lot of stories that he told me, and I don't want to in any way retell those stories, but I take snippets from those stories that he tells me, that he told me, and I take them into the documentary and explore parts of those stories. Specifically about his mother. I mean, he spoke a lot about his mother, but I never really knew, you know, who her friends were, how she lived, what kind of character was she, what kind of relationships did they have. Although he told me about his mother and how much he loved her and so on. So that's just to give you an idea that, you know, there's certain things that we really focused on that's of personal interest to me. And those things stem from the stories he really told me.
So let me take you back almost 20 years. Tell me about that initial meeting with the man himself.
Okay, yes, a life-changing moment, of course, as for many other people as well, when they met Nelson Mandela for the first time. It was 1994 when I started working in his office. I was, of course, employed by his private secretary, Mary Mkladana. She was, you know, working in his office she started a few months before me, and she urgently needed an assistant. I happened to be at the Union Buildings at the right time, at the right place on a particular day when Mary burst into this office and announced that she needed an assistant. So I didn't really know what to expect, and for the first 2 weeks into the job, whenever I heard the president arrive, I locked my office door. I was still afraid of him because, remember, I was sold a narrative in which we are enemies, in which our ideals can't reconcile. So I don't know what to expect of this person, and I'm quite aware that at that point that I'm responsible, you know, being an white Afrikaner for what had happened to this man. So I feel guilty as well. So I locked my office door whenever I heard him arrive. And about 2 weeks into the job, I walked into Mary's office to deliver a document and nearly bumped into him. He was surrounded by bodyguards, and I realized, you know, because of their physique, that these were all bodyguards. And then he stood in front of me, and it was a shock at first. Initially, it's just a shock, being confronted with this larger-than-life figure. I mean, he was as tall as I am, 2 centimeters taller, and he smiles at me. And I'm confused immediately because I'm not expecting him to smile. I'm expecting an angry face. And the first thing, many people will agree, the first thing that you noticed when you met Nelson Mandela for the first time is this incredible kindness in his eyes and that infectious smile of his and just the generosity on his face overall. And he's extending his hand, and I thought to myself, well, is it proper to shake hands with the president? I wanted to run away. but then I took his hand, and immediately I felt the calluses inside his hands from, of course, the work, the years of hard labor on Robben Island. And there was suddenly a pause, and I realized, wait, the president asked me something, and I was so confused, and I clearly realized I didn't hear what he was asking. So I said, not even pardon me, I said, excuse me, Mr. President, I was just so shocked. And when he repeated himself, I realized he was speaking to me in Afrikaans. Now, it's not that his Afrikaans wasn't good, but my brain wasn't wired to expect that he would speak to me in this much hated, so-called hated language of the oppressor. And I was so shocked because he really showed an interest in me. And in that moment, I think I was present in my life for the first time, where I was absent from history and absent from my own life for much before that. In that moment, Madiba grasped it by showing me the person that I never expected him to be and showing me the opposite of what I was brought to believe about him. And it was quite a shock to my system. And he asked about my family and about my upbringing. And we stood there and, you know, I I was completely overcome with emotion, and I just started crying, as many people did whenever they met him, as I saw them when they met him over the years. And he was still holding onto my hand, and he saw that I was crying, tears just rolling down my face. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, no, relax. You are overreacting now. And, I mean, when a president tells you you are overreacting, you compose yourself.
Well, never mind a president. This is Nelson Mandela.
Exactly, exactly. But, I subsequently saw that people are so overtaken by this moment when they meet Madiba for the first time. Him almost exposing himself to every person that he met. It was the raw emotion, that raw authenticity almost in him, that baffled people, that people generally broke out and sobbed and cried and couldn't speak, and they all kinds of emotions. But it was a very common response from people. And over the years, of course, I then realized what people are doing, and I used to say to them, don't cry, because can I tell you something? Now, you have one moment to meet Madiba, and for the rest of your life, you're only going to remember that you cried. So take it from me. This is the best advice I can give you. Sour the moment and just be happy and converse with him. It didn't always help, of course, and people didn't take advice freely sometimes. So, it was quite interesting to watch, but he personified the best version of a human being that we all so desperately want to be, and that's what intrigued people all over the world.
And that was the start of this long and really beautiful relationship. You didn't just work for him, you had eventually become his friend. And what was that journey like over nearly two decades with the man that everyone revered?
Look, at first it was a very formal kind of relationship, because I was also brought up in a house where there's a great deal of respect for seniority. And even though politically Madiba and I at that stage, I didn't buy into his ideology immediately, because I didn't know better. I didn't know what he was about, his ideals and so on. But I had this inherent respect for the person because he was a president. That's how we were brought up. So it was a formal kind of relationship for the first few years. And when he, of course, noticed my complete dedication to this job, it consumed my life. I was in it 200%. I was always first to arrive at the office. I was always first to react when he needed something from someone, one of the assistants to help. And, of course, then our relationship really changed in 1999. When he retired, and he could choose one person to work into retirement with him, and then, of course, he chose me, which I still consider the biggest honor of my life. Then the relationship transformed to another level. Then it became like a grandfather, granddaughter, because now there's no infrastructure, there's no other stuff, it's just us. And we travel together and we work together and we are almost codependent, because I'm depending on him not to fire me because I don't have another job, and I really want this to work and I really want to be successful in supporting him. And he gets very used to the fact that I answer the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning, or I'm always there and always on time, and I'm so over-dedicating myself, so over-extending myself rather. So it was at the end, it was a grandfather-granddaughter relationship, and I loved him dearly. It was really like my dearest grandfather as well.
And, everyone wanted to meet the man. So how did he react to that, or were you the buffer between those hundreds, thousands of people and him?
Yes, it was daunting. I mean, the pressure was relentless. Over the years, I realized that, if Madiba could just sit in a chair all day and open his doors and everyone just stream in as in they wish, they would probably have killed him. He wouldn't have had energy to do anything else. And it would really be exhausting. He would be happy to do that. The problem is that, many people didn't really come for just the meeting or just the photo. You had to make sure That there was no hidden agendas. You know that the relationship is a clean, reputable one. You know all those little things that we now know of. The checks and balances had to be done before he meets anyone. So it was a difficult process, and he didn't always. In the beginning, it was difficult to persuade him that it's to his own benefit that we have a structure in place where a few people actually take decisions about who he sees, when he sees them, what he does, what he associates with, because no one ever wanted to be, the person that makes a knee-jerk kind of decisions and then it turns out to be disastrous.
I don't know if you've ever been asked this before, but what was he like behind closed doors when all the adulation and all the fanfare around him had ended? It was just you and him in his office behind closed doors.
This incredible sense of humor. He would sit sometimes and read a newspaper and put down the newspaper and then think of something funny to say or think of, how to spin something in a funny way. He was completely comfortable with who he was, both in public and in private, but it wasn't a different person, or it wasn't two different people. It was very similar kind of characters. He didn't have a personality change as people expect him or expect it would be for a great statesman like that. He was very much the person that everyone saw. He was kind and generous, and with his time and his love, he was authentic. He was non-judgmental. But Madiba had his frailties. He always encouraged people. He said, remember, I have vices and virtues like everyone. So he could be stubborn sometimes. And if there was any kind of wastage around him, that would irritate him. If there was people that was disrespectful, it would irritate him. And then that side of Madiba is a side that you don't necessarily always saw in the public play out, because people always presented their best sides when they were in public with him. So when things like that happened, it was difficult to try and convince him, also to not to let go, but to move on very quickly. It's not that he held grudges at all, nothing like that. But, I'm in a bad mood. It's not a switch you turn on and off and then you are in a better mood. So, and for the next meeting, if someone angered him, for the next meeting, he had to be the kind person again. Because then that angry person, the person in front of him is not the person he's angry at. So, when there was a lot of discussions between the two of us, when I took wrong decisions or when I felt that he was unfair in a situation, we discussed it. But once he has taken note or cognizance of all people's input around him, he would stick to that point, and then that kind of stubbornness, to what his decision was, that is probably a side, the only side, that people didn't really know about him, of him.
Where were you when you heard that he had passed on?
I was in my house in Midrand. Actually, up to now, no one has called me. It's terrible, man. But actually, up to now, no one has told me in so many words that he has passed away. There was so much secrecy and smoke and mirrors around the last few days of his life. I saw Mrs. Machel on the Monday, and he passed away on the Thursday. I saw Mrs. Machel on the Monday, and I know her also quite well. So I could sense on her facial expression that things went well. It wasn't always necessary for me to ask. And I also didn't want to add to the pressure of millions of people asking her, how is Madiba? So I could read her to some extent as well, and I could see, things are not well. In the afternoon, I spoke to Josina Machel about something else, and I said, listen, I'm worried about Mum. It seems that she's very stressed. And Josina just said to me, yes, things are difficult. Then on the Thursday of his passing, Mrs. Michelle called me in the morning and she said, it was a strange request. She just said to me, remember that list you had drafted for me a few years ago about important people around Madiba? I need that list, a copy of that list again. And then I knew. Okay, you know, but now it's that anxiety of not knowing what to expect, when, how, has it happened, has it not happened. So I'm pretty much like everyone else watching the news, and I knew that, you know, it was on complete lockdown and they were not going to tell anyone. And looking back now, I appreciate it because, but in that moment, I was kind of frustrated and angry, not knowing what's going on. And then I went to work to the foundation in Houghton as usual during the day and went home before traffic. And about 5 o'clock, she called me again and she said to me, please call Archbishop Tutu, Uncle George Bezos, Mr. Kathrada, Mr. Mbeki, Judge Dikhongoseneki. Please call them and tell them, you know, things aren't looking good and we are expecting the worst. That's all. And, of course, now she's telling me, so it's not like I'm removed from this. Now I know too.
And you have to process those emotions as well.
Yes, yes. But most importantly to me was to give execution to a task and to do it in such a way without causing panic now. Although it is, you can't avoid panic in that stage. So now I'm starting to get hold of people. And I can't speak to a third person because I need to speak to that person directly because now I'm also on my own lockdown. I can't trust anyone because can you imagine the kind of chaos you can create if this now leaks? And I start getting hold of them one by one. And I think, who was it? Mr. Mbeki, when I called him, I think he was the last person I got hold of. And I said to him, and he didn't hear me clearly, and he said, you know, Mr. Mbeki has got that very stern way of responding sometimes. He said, what? And I was also always a bit afraid of him. And I said, I repeated myself, and he said, oh, okay. And he didn't put down the phone or say goodbye or nothing. I said, okay, sir, I'm thinking of you. Goodbye then. And then when I dropped that phone, it just poured out and I just cried. And this was probably about 7 o'clock in the evening. And as you know, Madiba passed away around 9 o'clock now. And I saw my phone picking up traffic, a lot of traffic. And people from America asking me what's going on. It's 7 o'clock in the evening, you know. He's not passed on yet, but the rumors are starting to do the rounds. And I then realized that I can't withstand this pressure. I can't deal with it because I don't know how to. And also, I don't want to lie to people. I don't want to be put in a position to say I don't know because I do know. So I switched off my phone and I drank a sleeping tablet and I went to bed. And I thought to myself, this is it. You know, there is absolutely nothing I can do. And I really switched off my phone and the next morning I woke up at about 4 o'clock and I switched it on and I mean, there was literally trillions of messages. I couldn't even go through all of them. I just realized I had to get ready and get to the foundation. And from I had very little time then for my own emotions. I just realized I couldn't happen. But up to today, I still also hadn't seen Mr. Mbeki announcing his pass, Mr. Zuma announcing his passing. So it was just, yeah, I was almost swept away in that moment.
If there is one thing about Madiba that you would take away after all these years of being his personal assistant and being his friend as well, what do you think that would be?
Terence, it is that absolute, absolute, pure respect for another human life. The fact that he didn't allow a person's achievements or misconduct or mistakes to to influence the person that he saw in front of him. He didn't judge a person by the color of his skin, his dress code, his wealth, his religion, or, you know, his appearance, nothing. Madiba connected to the human being that he found in front of him, and he always, it was a conscious decision to choose another person's humanity and to focus on that, irrespective of ideology and so on. So it is really, that it for me is the biggest asset of his legacy, for many people still to explore, is how is it possible to respect a human being to such an extent. I've tried to kind of practice it in my way, you know, to just, when I meet a person, when I come across a person, to treat that person just with the utmost respect and to expect the best of that person. Of course you are disappointed, but Madiba also never allowed his disappointments to influence his future interactions with people. So it is the greatest gift he's leaving to us, to show us how to truly be just an empathetic human being to another. So for me, that is the treasure of his legacy.
And so what is life like after Nelson Mandela? I know that you've poured your heart into the series of documentaries now. But other than that, what is your life like these days?
You know, he's Madiba, I'm very fortunate that he's still very much part of my life. He's with me every day in different ways. I still think of him every single day. And it's strange that the further I move away, the clearer things are becoming for me. You know, it's only now that I truly realize or accept this incredible privilege I've had of working with him. I promise you, after watching the second or the third episode of this documentary series, I wept. You know, that ugly one where you don't want people to see, you know, that ugly cry. And I thought to myself, for the first time, I thought to myself, do you realize what happened to you? Do you realize who you worked for? Do you realize how blessed you are to have known this person? And, you know, so he's very much still part of my life. I do motivational speaking. I share the lessons and my own change with people as well. The documentary, I work with some of his grandchildren from time to time on projects. So it is different because, you know, you miss the person you know, you would miss a parent or a grandparent or a sibling or whatever. You do miss that person's physical presence. But he's so present still in my memory and in my everyday life that it is true what a friend of mine said, that your relationship with a person doesn't end the day they pass on. That relationship continues just in a different way, and I truly believe that.
Finally, Zelda, what do you hope that this documentary series does?
Well, there's a few things, actually. I hope, first of all, that the target audience, of course, the first target audience is Afrikaans-speaking people, that they will see another side of Nelson Mandela that they may not have been exposed to previously. Remember, as I said earlier, we were sold a narrative in which Nelson Mandela was packaged to us in a particular way. I want to show people, Afrikaans-speaking people specifically, that he's not only the president that wore a rugby jersey and a rugby cap. There's much, much more to him, and I want to show them what that was all about. Secondly, I also hope to draw attention to the importance of us preserving our modern history. You know, Madiba's, the recent history, Madiba's history is all we have, really. And I think all history that all South Africans, you know, can share. So I hope to draw attention to some of these places of importance in his life. His schools, the community where he was brought up in Kekezweni in the Eastern Cape. where Dorke House is in Johannesburg, you know, that those areas, the prisons and so on. I hope to draw attention, and hopefully people will see that there's a lot of refurbishment or upgrade or maintenance to be done at these places. And unless we preserve it, in 50 years from now, there's going to be nothing left for people to try and interpret this wonderful history we have of Nelson Mandela. So I think those are the main issues that I wish the documentary focuses on and makes people think in a different way. And also it's just pure enjoyment. It is, you know, Karin Loubser is an excellent director. She just has the ability to see things like no one else. And the footage you will see of South Africa, I mean, of every part in rural South Africa that played a role in Madiba's life, the footage will be the greatest part of entertainment for people, for South Africans, and, you know, even people abroad that watch it. It is really the most beautiful I've seen of my own country.
Well, we're looking forward to this. I wish you well with the documentary and with whatever else you're doing.
You're very generous, Terence. Thank you for all your time, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity.
Always. Thanks.